Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How do unidentified dead bodies get forgotten when investigations hit a dead end? And what keeps some people with no direct link to these cases hunting for solutions? Despite the ease with which crime drama detectives seem to wrap up murder probes, in real-life America, tens of thousands of human remains are unidentified, some of which were discovered decades ago. But as my guest today will tell us, the internet has given rise to an obsessive, fiercely competitive subculture of hobbyists who reopen these cases on their own time for the sake of criminal justice, but also of closure for families living without knowledge of whatever happened to their missing loved ones. Journalist Deborah Halber's book is called The Skeleton Crew: How Amateur Sleuths Are Solving America's Coldest Cases. Deborah, welcome to Think.
Thanks, Chris. Thanks for having me.
This is a fascinating little slice of life in America that I knew nothing about. How did you become aware of this phenomenon of amateurs trying to solve real crimes, identify remains?
Well, I really came upon it accidentally myself. The first thing that I saw was a photograph in the Boston Globe, and it was this woman with this long reddish hair and these beautiful eyes, and she had this kind of enigmatic Mona Lisa smile. And then I realized this wasn't a photograph of a living person, but it was a digital reconstruction of what this murder victim had looked like before she had been found, with her hands cut off and her head bashed in on the beach in Provincetown, Massachusetts in 1974. And I realized then that you know, it was just inexplicable to me how she had never been identified. And then I realized that hers wasn't an isolated case.
And because there are times when a body is found, but no one claims that individual as missing. And there are other times when someone goes missing and there doesn't appear to be a body found that matches the description.
Yes, that's true. There are It's not just that some bodies are unclaimed, because some of those people can be identified and then they just can't find any known relatives to claim the body. The ones that I discuss in my book are ones that they just have absolutely no clue who this person is. They just can't, they have either no ID, there's nothing in the, you know, among the person's effects that can indicate their name.
So let's talk about why it's so hard to identify certain remains. On TV, it's usually sort of a body that has freshly died. But in fact, sometimes human remains are found long after the person has stopped living.
Yes, that is the case for a lot of the people that have that have been unidentified for decades. Some of them were actually skeletons when they were found. But it really kind of depends on, the area they're found and how good the forensic anthropologists are in that area. Some coroners, some medical examiners don't even have access to people who can sort of read the clues of a body, and sometimes there are clues on an intact body, you know, maybe tattoos or scars, but there are a lot of clues that they can actually read from skeletons as well, former surgeries, broken bones, but it's certainly, as you mentioned, it is absolutely nothing like what you see on TV where, you know, all sorts of IDs and pictures and information pops up on screens, you know, somewhat magically. It's just not like that in real life.
You mentioned coroners and medical examiners. I think many people use those terms interchangeably, but in fact, they mean different things.
Yes. So a coroner is an elected appointment, an elected official. They have to run for that office. They within a county. say, and they do need to be voted in. A medical examiner is an appointed position, and there's controversy between the groups. A medical examiner might typically have more of a background and an education in this kind of field, and a coroner doesn't necessarily have that medical background, but that's not always the case.
And so depending on the jurisdiction where a body is found and the resources available within that jurisdiction, unidentified remains can be processed minimally, or they can sort of get a really thorough going over.
Yes, exactly. When the Bureau of Justice Statistics set out to try to quantify this problem, they realized there was just such a huge variation from location to location. There were usually in a bigger city, there was decent record keeping. There were policies in place about how you even treated one of these bodies, whether you collected samples of DNA, whether you kept any kind of records of exactly what had been found in the autopsy. And there were other places where the person, and this was often decades ago, where the person was often just cremated or buried in a potter's field, and a lot of the clues that might have led to their ID would virtually disappear.
What about DNA, which seems to be the solution to every problem these days? It doesn't always work in these cases.
Yeah, with DNA, you actually need a sample to compare it to, or else it's not really going to help you. So DNA, is fairly recent phenomenon for many of these the bodies that I've been investigating. So without that sample, without families of the missing have been requested to provide samples, and having all those samples in a central database, it's DNA isn't going to do you a lot of good.
All right, so at the heart of your book is this long unsolved case of a woman who came to be known as Tent Girl, and you open the book with a meeting that you had with a man who found her remains.
Yes, I went to Kentucky. A Tent Girl was kind of an apocryphal case in this area of Georgetown, Kentucky. It was, everybody knew about her. She was buried in the local cemetery under a headstone that actually all it had on it was a police sketch carved into the granite and a few details about where she'd been found. So this man, Wilbur Riddle, who was a well driller in 1968, he was out in a rural area, and he literally stumbled upon this body that looked like she was wrapped up in a carnival tent. And she wasn't ID'd. No one knew her name, anything about her. And she kind of rapidly became known as Tent Girl.
And there was media attention at the time because it was this unsolved case, but nobody, there were theories, but I guess nobody was really able to find anything definitive about her.
Exactly. So time went on, and fast forward 20 years. There's a 17-year-old kid living in Tennessee who meets Wilbur Riddle. Wilbur Riddle actually would become his father-in-law. He married Riddle's daughter, Lori. And his name is Todd Matthews. And so as soon as he heard the story from Wilbur, he just became obsessed with this poor unidentified girl who at the time they thought was a teenager who would have been around his age. And he just felt this psychic connection. He just felt like it was going to be him to give her back her name. And he spent the next 10 years of his life trying to do exactly that.
How did Todd Matthews begin this search? And I mean, where do you start with something like this?
Well, at the time, which was the late 80s, it wasn't, there wasn't much. There were very few internet tools, but there were starting to be, for the initial part of his search, he did just the very traditional kind of thing. He would call coroner's offices, call law enforcement, look at newspaper archives. He basically just sort of went over everything that might be out there that he thought might give him some sort of clue. But over time, there started to be these kind of very archaic, today we would consider them very archaic-looking databases, where you could upload information about different topics. And people kind of separately from Todd started doing this. They realized that they could take information about bodies that had been discovered around the country and post it online in centralized databases. And then when other people found this, they realized that they could try to match some of it, this information, to information that was out there about missing persons. And that's when the Internet started playing a big role in this.
And, of course, the possibilities expanded a great deal if Tent Girl turned out not to be a teenager but a young woman.
Yeah, so that was part of Todd's thinking over the years. He, you know, at first the thought was that she was in her teens, and then really one of the very few clues was that there was like a piece of white, it looked like almost like a white towel draped over her shoulder. And he started wondering, what if this towel, what if it wasn't a towel, but what if it was a baby's diaper? What if she was a young mother? And he didn't know it at the time, but he had actually, guessed it. She turned out to be a little older than they had thought. She turned out to be in her 20s, and she was, in fact, a young mother.
So how did it happen that Todd came to the solution, and what kind of attention did he get when it was clear that he had the right idea about who this was?
So just let me, I'd like to just back up a little bit and say that Todd's voyage in this was particularly unusual and particularly tough for a number of reasons. He, not only was he a pretty young man, he he had married Lori Riddle, and they were really just a couple of kids. They were living in a trailer home. He was working just a night shift in an auto parts factory. It was a tough time for them financially, and yet he was so obsessed with this case that he was actually jeopardizing his financial status and his marriage. Lori was getting pretty fed up with this, and they had their own child in a few years, and so he was actually ignoring his family at the time to pursue this case. When he started the turning point really came, as I mentioned, when these internet databases started popping up, and message boards and bulletin boards. And he was perusing one late one night and came across a notice that a woman had posted looking for her sister. It only said a few things: dark hair, dark eyes, last seen in Kentucky, 1968. But he just saw that, and he felt like it just had to be her, that he just knew that was Tent Girl.
My guest is journalist Deborah Halver. We're talking about her new book, The Skeleton Crew, How Amateur Sleuths Are Solving America's Coldest Cases. We'll resume our conversation in a couple of minutes. If you want to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org, or you can send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this fall to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree with concentrations in human rights, creative writing, and organizational dynamics. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is journalist Deborah Halber. Her new book is called The Skeleton Crew: How Amateur Sleuths Are Solving America's Coldest Cases. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372, email think@kera.org, or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think. Deborah, one interesting thing about Todd that seems to be a thread that joins several of the people you profile in this story is that he had suffered some losses in his personal life, which seems to have affected the way he felt about death, maybe his relationship to death and what it meant.
Yeah, I think that's true. He had had two siblings born who had died just within hours of birth. And his parents just continued a sort of a relationship with these infants. They were buried in the family plot. They would visit them. And as a young boy, Todd was kind of struck by the idea that these siblings were just never really a part of his life as living children, but in the family dynamic, they were still very present. So I think he had a sense that there are dead people out there that you can have a relationship with. So I think that did inform his relationship with Tent Girl.
So let's go back now to the what happened when the Tent Girl case broke.
So at the time he'd come across this notice on a bulletin board, a woman looking for her long lost sister. He was personally convinced that this had to be Tent Girl. Now, when he thinks back on what he did, he's pretty shocked with his own behavior, which was that he immediately contacted this woman and said, "I think I know where your sister is." He knows now that that's a pretty dangerous thing to do. For one thing, he was just going on a hunch. No real testing had been done yet. He didn't know if it was even possible to confirm that Tent Girl was this woman's sister who's been missing. Her name was Barbara Ann Hackman. So he did contact her, and they did manage to do an exhumation and get some DNA, and it was in fact confirmed that Tent Girl was Barbara Ann Hackman.
So how did Todd begin to build a greater online presence and reputation?
Well, at that point, he was involved with a group that it had been around for a couple of years. He was one of the very first members of this organization called the Doe Network, as in Jane and John Doe's. Mm-hmm. But it has been other people who had actually created this database. But he stuck with it. He sort of worked his way up in the organization. And he just remained involved with this growing web sleuth community. His solving of that particular case had launched, I think, a feeling that this kind of thing could be done. It was like people were, okay, now look, so the internet is here. These are the tools. This man actually was able to perform an ID this way. Maybe we can take a look. Maybe we can do more.
So the official name was Doe Network. There are law enforcement officials who have a different name for it.
Yes. The law enforcement, there are cops who call it the Donuts. They felt early on that when they started getting calls from these people asking for more information about cases that they weren't even personally connected to. I think a lot of law enforcement looked askance at this phenomenon, didn't think it was such a great idea that they were suddenly demanding information. But then again, law enforcement is not usually into sharing. So they didn't really want to put out a lot of information. On the other hand, a lot of these cases were so old and so cold that they really needed another set of eyes.
So how did this community start to develop like standards and practices for when they would approach law enforcement or approach family members with their ideas about things?
There became a bit of a divide in the community as it evolved over the decade after Tent Girl was ID'd. There were those who felt that they wanted to be working behind the scenes, helping law enforcement, being really good assistants more than anything else. And then there were those in the community who would really rather interact with law enforcement directly. So this became a matter of some contention. There were, and it actually created splinter groups and made certain, and actually made the DOE network kind of explode at some point, and then had to be sort of put back together.
So talk a little bit about, there is online, there is some collaboration that takes place. There's a lot of sniping back and forth, not only across the divide that you mentioned, but over a variety of other issues. Why is this such a contentious field?
Well, you know, it did take me by surprise. My initial inclination was these online sleuths and this web community was all about compassion and volunteer work, and they were really putting themselves out there to do this kind of selfless, unpaid work with no recognition for the families. But it sort of did take me by surprise that online communities could be so rife with controversy and sniping and backstabbing. But then again, I believe that I'd never been involved this deeply in any online community myself. And I don't think the Web Sleuth community is unique in that respect. I think a lot of the really nasty sniping is tied to anonymity and screen names, and, you know, just personality clashes would get elevated in ways that I'd like to think would never happen in person.
So another thing that seems to be interesting about many of the people you profile here is that there are those who sort of use this to create some meaning in their lives where maybe their jobs are not that satisfying or not that challenging.
Yeah, a lot of these people are, I would say they're underemployed, and they're quite smart. A lot of them have an amazing ability to look through a tremendous amount of information and make connections. But it, generally, the ones that I got to know really well were working at jobs, blue-collar jobs that were not, that they did not consider intellectually challenging. Some of them might work in Home Depot or in supermarkets. And then they came home at night, and, you know, I mean, who doesn't love a mystery? But they would get really caught up in particular cases, and they'd spend hours and hours just searching through the inner recesses of the Internet to try to find out if somebody they suspected, if an unidentified person they suspected was tied to a missing person, they would just look for anything they could find to make that case.
Tell us about Ellen Leach. How did she get into this?
So Ellen Leach, like most of the people, came across the DOE network pretty much accidentally. But she got really involved by... Because she just wanted to solve a case. And she took on some of the most challenging ones that were out there.
And are there rewards available for people who do this work? Or are there simply, is it really just the intangible reward of having done a good thing?
Well, in one case that, it's really a truly astounding case that I describe in the book, in a chapter I call The Head in the Bucket, Ellen Leach actually managed to come up with an ID for a man whose decapitated head had been found in a bucket of hardened concrete. There was really no law enforcement in Missouri where that was found, had no idea who this man was. She managed to connect him to a man who was missing in Iowa, who police knew pretty much had been murdered, but they had no body. So they were progressing with a murder trial in Iowa, where it would have been literally the state's first conviction without a body, and they were pretty nervous about going ahead with the case. But she managed to ID him just in the nick of time, and they managed to put this murderer away for life. There actually was a reward associated with that. The family of the missing victim had offered a $15,000 reward, which Ellen did actually get. But generally, no, there are no financial rewards associated with this.
And Ellen Leach was actually related somewhat distantly to a rather infamous figure, Susan Smith.
Yes, that was what first led her to look online to begin with. Not a very close family connection. Cousins, I believe. The Susan Smith's children were cousins. And Ellen was just watching this drama unfold. At the time, if you recall, it was everyone initially thought this, you know, this woman was saying that her children had been kidnapped. In fact, she had let her car, you know, roll into a body of water with the children strapped into their car seats. It was just a horrible case, but it was the one that had Ellen first become aware that there were places on the internet where you could go to search out clues about somebody who might have been, let's say, kidnapped or was missing.
So she started looking for clues to what she initially thought was the legitimate story that her cousin had told about these poor children who were killed, and then just stayed there after that case became clear that it was about something very different.
Yes. So all the stories that I tell in my book start the same way. They start with a body being found. And then the mystery becomes, who was this person? So what Ellen did and what a lot of these web sleuths do is they come across a description of a body being found. And then they just kind of get sucked into the mystery, into the challenge. And that's exactly what happened to Ellen. She just, she's been actually a pretty prolific web sleuth, even though she does still work many, many hours on her day job. She's persisting in this, and she's, I think, solved at least six cases.
Once somebody has a reputation like that, do law enforcement agencies start to come to them and say, hey, do you want to take a look at this?
It depends. In some areas, they do. There is a detective in Phoenix, Arizona, who's in charge of cold cases. And he actually claims to me that he's become fairly dependent on some of the web sleuths. He has a few people that he trusts that he knows are really amazing researchers. And he says that they've come up with information that has helped him solve some cases that he doesn't think he'd be able to have done on his own.
How have databases of missing persons and of unidentified remains changed since, say, the late 90s?
Well, the Doe Network is still around. There are others as well. There's websleuths.com. There's the Charlie Project. But probably the biggest change that's happened is that there's actually now a government-sponsored database, a National Institute of Justice initiative called the National Missing and Unidentified Person Network. It's called NAMIS for short. And it's not yet, there's still no national requirement of any kind for law enforcement or medical examiners to input biometrics into that system, although that might change in the future. But the biggest thing about NAMIS is that it's available to the public. It's available to law enforcement, to coroners, medical examiners, as well as the public. So families of missing people can actually go in there and input data that they feel would be helpful to law enforcement. Anybody can log in and search, let's say, if they're curious about the unidentified remains in their particular state, they can search for that. It's really a motherload of information.
Hmm. Okay, so the fact that this is available to anybody is great in some ways, right? Because lots of different minds can get together and work on these things. It also has to mean that there's some crackpots taking part in this, right?
Well, I mean, I think Namus in particular, I think, you know, is quite... I'm not sure there would be a way. I hope there isn't a way for anybody to misuse that system. But for organizations like the Doe Network, they're one of the ones that feel like they would like to be the behind-the-scenes helpmates to law enforcement. So they actually have a panel of volunteers who review every proposed match. So the members might say, I think this person in Florida could be this missing person from Nevada, but they won't send that information on to law enforcement without reviewing it and seeing if there is enough there to go on if it does look like it's a potential match.
There are some people that just have amazing skills, like they can look at hundreds of photographs and keep those details in their heads.
Yes, there's a woman I met who is in South Carolina, and she had this amazing ability to look through dozens of photos, and I call these some of these sites, I call them like Facebook for the dead, because there were just thumbnail sketches or facial reconstructions or some actual morgue photos, and it's quite chilling on one level, and it's also just information overload on another. There are just so many of these pictures that you can scan through, and then of course there are the photographs of the missing. But she had this ability to go through all of them and say to herself, "Hey, I feel like I've seen that feature before," and that was her method of doing this.
My guest is journalist Deborah Halber. Her new book is called The Skeleton Crew, How Amateur Sleuths Are Solving America's Coldest Cases. If you've got a question or want to tell a story, you can call 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this fall to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree with concentrations in human rights, creative writing, and organizational dynamics. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with journalist Deborah Halber. Her new book is called The Skeleton Crew, How Amateur Sleuths Are Solving America's Coldest Cases. You can join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. Another surprise, Deborah, reading this book that makes it clear that the stuff we see on TV is not necessarily accurate, is that people who do forensics work, a lot of their tools are sort of improvised. Some of it is very low tech, and it's not like they can press a button and instantly have a reconstruction of, say, a face or a head, that sort of thing.
It really varies from jurisdiction to jurisdiction. Sometimes there are police artists who can do a sketch, the same kind of artists who might, if a witness comes to them and describes a suspect, they could provide a sketch of the suspect. Those same artists can sometimes look at morgue photos and try to do a reconstruction of the unidentified. In other places, there are elaborate systems in place to they use state-of-the-art digital forensic reconstructions. They produce these things that look like photos, like the one I mentioned early on that I saw in the Boston Globe to me looked identical to a photograph, but in fact was an artist's reconstruction of putting together what a face would have looked like before it decomposition set in.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now to Jim in Rowlett. Hi, Jim.
Hi.
Hi, go right ahead, please.
Yeah, I just wanted to know if your author there had or yet had ever written any of Kathy Reich's books. She's a forensic anthropologist who works out of the University of North Carolina and also in Montreal.
I am a big fan of Bones, which I guess is produced by Kathy Reichs, and I just love that show. But it's just funny how different it is from what I hear from the web sleuths themselves. For instance, Todd Matthews, who actually now works with the University of North Texas, the Center for Human Identification, he said to his boss, "Hey, I want one of those boards like they have in Bones." And his boss said, "Well, I'll get you a whiteboard."
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next on the phone to Vincent calling from Colorado. Hi, Vincent.
How you doing?
Great, thank you.
I just want to tell you a little story about some human remains we found in our backyard about 6 years ago. We have about 180 acres and a little bear. We found a femur and a skull, and we turned into police. It actually happened to be residents that lived on this farm about 80 years ago, and it was one of their great-grandparents that disappeared.
Hmm.
Might have been, but it was, 80 years ago. It was pretty unbelievable that they identified a body and closed the case for family members.
Do you know anything about the process, Vincent, about how they figured out who this was?
I don't remember. It was just recorded down as a body that was never identified, and then just didn't check, I guess, a certain part of the property. Maybe it was dismembered by an animal or whatever, and it was scattered, but helps people get closure.
Thanks so much for your call. Deborah, it seems that a lot of people who are doing this work really are doing it with an eye toward providing some relief for family members who never have known what happened.
I think that that's true. I think initially when people come across a case and they get sucked in, I think initially it's the mystery, the challenge, the mind-boggling sense that how could this person just not be identified? And they sort of adopt these cases, some of them, and they become their own case. And then as time goes on, I think they really do feel for the family, and they realize that this person had to have friends, relatives who never knew what became of them. So in the end, I do believe it becomes a matter of compassion and wanting to provide closure for a family.
Let's go back to the phones now. This time we have Chris on the line in Dallas. Hi, Chris.
Hi there. Just had a quick question for your guest about kind of the etiquette of how a community member should approach their local police department. How would you, for example, find out which detective a case was assigned to? How would you offer them your help if you had any without feeling like without frustrating the officers,
That's a really good question. I think it really does vary pretty widely from jurisdiction to jurisdiction. I mean, in some places, from what I've heard, these web sleuths have actually just called and introduced themselves and asked. They describe the case that they're particularly interested in and just asked whether the department even has a cold case detective to begin with, and a lot of them don't. But you might be prepared for, a whole range of responses, ranging from that they welcome your help and they'll tell you what you can do to bug off, essentially. But that's the beauty of NamUs, because you can go on that yourself and just search for your local area and just start poking around a little bit, and nobody would, bother you doing that.
And I would guess that if you think you have the right answer to a case, you really only have one chance to get it right when you approach law enforcement, right? For them not to say, bug off, we got this, or we don't trust you.
It's really a difficult situation. A lot of these web sleuths actually put forward a lot of potential matches. And again, it just really depends on how open law enforcement in your particular area is to receiving those. I've spoken to lieutenants and sergeants who have gotten match after match after match, and they've pursued every single lead. And I don't know how common that is, but it does happen.
And I suppose they're probably happy to hear from amateur sleuths if they're giving them things they can really work with. But if it's a bunch of, you know, rabbit trails to chase, that's another story entirely.
Exactly. They really don't want to hear that, you know, something came to you in a dream or you have some sort of a psychic who told you, you know. But if you can run down a few items and say, look, this person had this kind of dental work. I see that there are dental records in the system for this other person. Maybe this is worth a look.
Deborah, how do these individuals who get involved in this begin to educate themselves about what one needs to know? I mean, I wouldn't know the first thing about trying to match unidentified remains with an identity.
It really varies, and it is about education. There is actually a death investigator that I spoke to in California who, if anybody ever happens to call him, he's more than willing to sort of educate them himself and say, look, we really need the biometrics. You know, in some cases, some of the web sleuths have actually gone out to families of the missing. They volunteer to do this. They go to families of the missing to get cheek swabs for DNA, to make some calls and see if dental records are available and can be input into the system. Sometimes it's really just a matter of getting all the information in one place so it can be compared. And it's definitely a challenge. It's, you know, really like looking for a needle in a haystack.
How long would a jurisdiction, and I'm sure you'll tell me this varies, but is there a standard amount of time that a jurisdiction would keep a body preserved before disposing of the remains by cremation or burial if those remains are unidentified?
I've heard of everything all across the map. I've heard of jurisdictions keeping elaborate records, keeping all sorts of biometrics, DNA samples, whatever they had. I've heard of jurisdictions even holding on to material in the hope that someday the technology would come about to lead to an ID. And it's really just completely depends on the individuals out there.
How closely do the numbers of unidentified remains match with the numbers of people reported missing? Because, of course, some missing people could have just disappeared for some other reason and be alive and well, but not in contact.
Yes, exactly. The National Institute of Justice, when it did set out to quantify this about 10 years ago, the figure they came up with was 40,000 unidentified remains around the U.S., and that was an extrapolation based on what minimal data they did actually manage to collect, and other people have told me they think that number is low. But I think at any one moment in the U.S., there are around 100,000 people reported missing, and those are just very, very different populations of people because, as you say, some of them are, choosing to be missing. Some of them are leaving their old lives behind, and that's not necessarily illegal. And there are people who are, temporarily missing and are, come home again very quickly. It's really the missing is just a very different situation from the unidentified.
Are there particular physical characteristics of remains that make amateur sleuths or professional detectives more optimistic that they'll be identified? Like, are you better off if you have a gold tooth and a tattoo?
Definitely. Those kinds of unique identifiers are really very valuable. There are ways to search databases based purely on a certain location and type of tattoo or a certain kind of dental work. Those things, I hate to say it, really do can make a big difference if there's nothing else about you that would lead to your name.
Did this research get you interested at all in trying to solve one of these cases?
Well, I did try. In my book, you'll see that I definitely peered over the shoulder of a lot of web sleuths, and especially with the Lady of the Dunes case that I became so interested in. I did try, but I found out that, in fact, I'd make a pretty bad web sleuth. There's so many details, and there's so much uncertainty about the accuracy of the information out there. There are those pages and pages of photos and reconstructions. The whole thing actually made me want to, you know, I just did not have the patience. It just took more than I had.
Do you sense that the hobbyists will get more professional as the online websites and databases are expanded and as there are more resources available to them? Will there be sort of annual conferences and that sort of thing?
That could be. That would be an interesting thing to happen. I did hear from one former cop who now works in this field of the unidentified. He feels that there will come a time when some of these web sleuths could sit side by side in police stations and help law enforcement, help, as I mentioned, maybe get family DNA samples, maybe input the information, which is one of the really big problems in law enforcement. This is very time-consuming to gather and input this information, yet it's so critical to have it in one database. And maybe someday people out there, just ordinary citizens, will be helping do that.
This is sort of a creepy question, but is anyone concerned that murderers could be looking at these online databases and these resources that people have set up in these clearinghouses to get ideas as to how to sort of better commit their crimes?
They certainly could be. I had one forensic anthropologist say to me when we were talking about ways that murderers sometimes try to make their victims unidentifiable. They know all about fingerprints. They know about DNA, you know, and as she put it, they watch the same TV shows we do.
Hmm. Did you find it hard to, did you get creeped out at any point during your research or the writing process?
Well, I discovered that I am not really a good candidate to walk through morgues. I found myself in that position a couple of times, and each time I was definitely feeling extremely uncomfortable. But you know, it really varies among people. I've had people tell me that they thought this entire topic was just too creepy to even contemplate, and I've had other people who've said that they're completely wrapped up in the details and doesn't bother them a bit.
Deborah Halber's book is called The Skeleton Crew: How Amateur Sleuths Are Solving America's Coldest Cases. Deborah, thank you so much for making time for us.
Thanks for having me.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. We had help on the phones today from Gus Contreras. You can find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think, and you can contact the show via email at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.